Okay, this is session number 23, December 11th, 2006. We're now moving into the Thompson part of the book. And he, like McLuhan, is on the right-hand page. LaRouche and Croker are on the left-hand page. We're sort of halfway through the LaRouche pages on the left-hand side. We finished McLuhan. Now we're starting Thompson on page 49, and he's on the right-hand page up to page and including 73. So it's a shorter section, but he deals with vast stretches of time. And the first quote we're going to do is from a book called Evil and World Order, which Harper and Row, the publisher in New York, put out in 1977. And Thompson at this time has just started 75, 76. He's got Lawrence Rockefeller to fund the Lindisfarne organization, and he's holding seminars with Gregory Bateson and other people in a church at the corner of West 20th Street and 6th Avenue in Manhattan. And that little church expelled the Lindisfarne group in 79-80, and Thompson retreated to Boulder, or an area in Colorado, not in Boulder, but outside, and the church became a disco, famous cocaine period disco in the 80s. Eventually bought up by a Canadian guy, and as a Canadian owner, he eventually got busted 6, 7, 8 years ago for kids being on ecstasy. So Thompson later comments on the fate of that church where Lindisfarne got located in the late 70s. So this first quote is the kind of thinking that he projected in the middle 70s. All right, so this is from the book Evil and World Order, probably a hard book to find. You know, maybe you could find it on used books and Amazon and that stuff. And it's a small book, and this is page 99.
Okay.
So take it away, Scott.
Yeah, and just for clarification, LaRouche on the left side, he spans McLuhan on the right side, Thompson on the right side, and also does he span Croker on the right side?
No, Coker's on the left side. Coker follows him on the left side.
Oh, okay.
He touches into me.
Oh, okay. And then we start getting Bob on the right side with Croker.
Yeah, and then eventually I'm on both sides.
Okay.
At the end of the book.
All right, so I'm going to begin reading this.
Yeah, this is from Evil and World Order by William Irwin Thompson, page 99.
In the planetary village of contemplatives, nature could be great, the machines tiny, and man in just proportion between the two. No longer need there be economics of scale in which massive amounts...
Economies
of scale in which massive amounts of fossil fuel are used to grow wheat in vast acreages so that huge trucks can burn gasoline to take flour into enormous cities where great factories can make rich crackers that can then be trucked again to airports so that jumbo jets can fly them into Venezuela, where multinational forms of advertising can convince peasants to abandon their locally made tortillas in favor of the creations of Nabisco. No longer would Madison Avenue heat up the economy so that shoddily built goods with built-in obsolescence could destroy non-renewable resources and produce disastrous pollution. In industrial society, you are what you own. In contemplative cultures, your being is the source of your identity. Contemplatives need less, consume less, and therefore can produce less. No man need labor 8 hours a day at the same dreary task of putting a door on a Cadillac. In industrial culture, poverty is a disgrace. In contemplative culture, poverty is the elegance of simplicity. As long as we continue to live in industrial culture, we will need an authoritarian government to control... To control unemployment, create jobs, subsidize the auto industry, and strip mine the Dakotas so that America can become one continental Los Angeles. If we have a spiritual transformation and create a meta-industrial culture, the drastic solutions of mass government will be unnecessary.
Okay, so here is Thompson coming in after McLuhan, and he's taking it for granted the points McLuhan said about the decentralized world, But as the...
And he's talking about the planetary village, so he doesn't even get McLuhan's idea of the planet, of the global theater.
No, he doesn't get that part. But he is dealing... Now, remember, on my chart, I've got LaRouche, McLuhan, Thompson, and Kroger all operating within the satellite effect. And so that LaRouche replays radio holopathically
right.
in the satellite frequency.
But in the inside the global theater, and McLuhan's the only one who gets it about the global theater.
Right. But the point is that the global theater is obsolesced by the instant replay. And the instant replay, which is a beginning of the digital culture, is what we're going to get from Thompson. We're going to get instant replays of vast tracts of written history, and he surfs over them. And he's dealing with a computerized and the becoming digital world, which miniaturizes the global theater, shrinks it down. So his vision is post-global theater, post-television, and into the miniaturized, what he calls here, he just talks about all the big stuff. You know what I mean? The big industrial cultures.
Mm-hmm.
And then he says that this is a meta-industrial culture, the shrunk down, miniaturized, more simple, less consumption-oriented culture based on digital technology is not industrial, but meta. It goes around the meta.
Mm-hmm.
It shrinks it. We'll see this in later quotes about the recapitulation of the big in tiny form. It's basically what Bucky Fuller called etherealization. So I'm just looking through. Was there another point where he talked about smallness? No, he didn't have that there, just meta-industrial. But he's talking about a planetary village of contemplatives.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, nature could be great. The machines, tiny. There it is. The machines are tiny. So
he sounds a bit, he's got a little bit, he's sort of weaving his politics in here, which are a little unrealistic. I mean, he's not going to change the world by having these thoughts. He sounds a bit angry, a bit rebellious about the way that things are, and
that's why I put him in the politics quadrant
mm-hmm.
in my on my chart. You'll see politics is and that's after all the orgies of the 60s and the early 70s. People now are into ecology and trying to get political or try to adapt some kind of concrete, practical social structure.
Right.
They sort of stopped their narcissism, even though in the 60s there was a lot of political turmoil, but it was all in anger. By the 70s, people are trying to come up with some kind of solution, so some kind of up-to-date solution dealing with the computerized cottage economy, and so E.F. Shoemaker became popular. He was a member of Lindisfarne. I think he spoke at the Lindisfarne Chapel on West 20th Street in the corner of 6th Avenue. Shoemaker did the book Small is Beautiful.
Mm.
Remember that? So that whole idea. So people are starting to feel that and intuit the miniaturization of media.
Now, LaRouche, Kroger, and William Rowan Thompson are all political. They all have that. They're all weaving politics into their thoughts. McLuhan is the only one who doesn't really seem to take a political stand. He's more neutral.
Right, because he, from his point of view, sees that politics has moved into another realm of media hypnotism, media power, and he thinks he's really being political in what he encounters. And everybody else is dealing with old 19th century issues.
Mm-hmm.
But Thompson is political in the sense he understands McLuhan and realizes a different world than LaRouche does.
Mm-hmm. Now, how would you play Thompson's politics off of LaRouche's politics? How do they juxtapose and compare and contrast?
Well, green, in the cartoon level of media coverage, it's green versus right wing.
Uh-huh, yeah. I don't imagine Thompson's into nuclear power facilities like LaRouche was.
As a matter of fact, Thompson was very aware of his alter ego or his dialectic with LaRouche, and when he would write essays in the 80s, in 1986 he laid out a whole agenda based around the cooperation of the Soviet Union and the United States, and they would move to Amory Lovins and people who created solar technology, wind forms of energy, they were members of Linda's Farm. So Thompson sought out the people that weren't nuclear fusion people, and he would say in his polemics that we can move the Democratic Party to this way of green thinking, in quotes green thinking, and siphon off the attraction LaRouche will have with his nuclear fusion ideologues. So that he would always single out LaRouche as his competitor.
Hmm. Well, but LaRouche is, apart from the fact that he's running this interesting holographic sort of, you know, he's got his own cult going on there, which is very potent in a way, but he's impotent on the world scene. He's never going to have an impact, so why would Croker, why would Thompson even care about LaRouche's agenda?
Well, actually, in 1986, when he wrote this this article for Whole Earth Review, I think it was in, that was the year that LaRouche reached his peak. A couple of his lieutenants were nominated in the state races in Indiana, or Chicago, was Chicago the capital of Indiana? In Illinois. And or maybe they're in Indiana, one of the I states. But anyways, and that was in the spring of 86. Then LaRouche got on Larry King, and he was really revving up, and people, a lot of people were joining his movement, and that's why he was busted in October 86. So LaRouche did get the peak of his media effect, even though he was being used behind the scenes. But aside from that, in terms of just media coverage, it was in 86 that he became prominent. And Thompson was always aware of what was going on in the media, and so he saw LaRouche. At that point, you didn't know what would happen to LaRouche. You didn't know if he would keep expanding. He quickly got put down.
What do you mean he was being used behind the scenes? Who was using LaRouche?
Me, but that's... I don't want to get into that right now.
And so, and it was Kissinger who busted him, right?
Yes.
And would you, do you believe that they were trumped up charges, or they were real? There was a real problem going on there with LaRouche and the credit card thing scandal.
Well, they were technically allowed to go to old women and get their money, you know, and they donate political. There's nothing wrong with that. But then the regular culture frowns on that. You see, so you got community values, or you got the Democratic Party saying, well, we don't raise money like that. We don't go to old women and claim that we've got all the ideas and join us and donate to us. So it becomes nebulous. And definitely when they first went after LaRouche, the case didn't hold in early 80, and he got let off. But then in late 88, they came up with some other charges. So I would say it was partly justified and partly illegal in the busting of LaRouche. So it's in the interval. But when you're dealing with a media culture, it doesn't matter. If you've got a bad image and they promote it that way, no matter what you do, it can be spun that you ripped off these old ladies.
Yeah.
So, probably LaRouche wasn't media savvy enough to deal with that.
Mm.
I mean, when he did his press conference at the National Press Club in that period in 86, I think it was, he started ranting and raving, you know. He didn't understand how to be cool on television. He remained hot within the television medium. I remember someone telling, it might have been Frank Zingroni, he saw some of LaRouche's campaign broadcasts, and he had a lot of them out, you know, every few years, especially during election years, 84 and 88 and 86. He had a lot of half-hour, you know, bought time that he would lay out stuff. But Frank Zingroni says anybody who would pick his nose in the middle of a broadcast just doesn't have any modern savviness for the TV culture. And LaRouche did that. He would be talking, and then he just sort of move his finger up and sort of pick at his nose, just sort of absentmindedly while addressing the nation, you know?
Yeah.
It's a kind of crude worker level, or crude, whatever you call it.
Blue-collar.
What?
Blue-collar.
Blue-collar, redneck, or just working class, even though LaRouche never really presented himself as working class. He was a leader, intellectual leader, who had come out of the working class, but he wore suits all the time.
Yeah.
It's just a certain lack of awareness of your body image in relation to the camera.
Well,
maybe people didn't even notice
that's
what Zingroni noticed. Zingroni got upset about it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It did look odd, though, because with the tactile TV image, if you pick your nose on TV, you're picking your viewer's nose, because they will feel it, because your image is inside them.
Yeah.
Okay, what were you going to say?
Well, also, I don't think I'm projecting this on him. You can tell me if you experience this to be true, but when I hear LaRouche speak, he has a bit of a style of speaking that almost sounds elitist or provincial or
snobbish.
Yeah, but yet he's representing, you know, the working guy. So that's a bit of a weird contrast.
But it gets odd because he represents the working guy in cultural sophistication. His citing of Leibniz and Beethoven, the details of culture, of highbrow literary culture, which the average working class doesn't have any clue of, makes him look odd.
Yeah.
I mean, he's representing blue by being red.
Mm-hmm.
So, now Thompson himself, when Bill Moyers did a big documentary on him in 1979, 1980, it was broadcast, you know, whole hour talking to Thompson. It was just like when McLuhan had a documentary done on him by NBC about spring of 67. So here it is 13 years later, and Thompson is 79-80 period. Sometimes I think it's 79. But anyways, I saw it. It was on Bill Moyers, and who had a big show at that time on PBS. So they had a whole hour around Thompson. And Thompson got 50,000 letters, he says, after that show. And he realized how stupid it was to try to get your message out in the major, big, huge media, because you wouldn't be able to deal with the response. And Thompson, being a kind of a interpersonal, one-on-one kind of person, he thought he had to respond to every person one-on-one, I guess. So he withdrew from having media coverage. So he couldn't handle the media, neither could LaRouche, but they did it the opposite way. Thompson might have been charismatic, but he just couldn't handle the effect of massive coverage of himself. So he withdrew, and LaRouche, who didn't have a good TV image, plunged into the TV scene.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
So what we have here, he's running through, basically what we have, big is bad and small is beautiful. You can see the E.F. Shoemaker idealism in this quote.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to stress that this is a 70s mentality, a 70s meme, a post-solar theater, post-global theater reality.
Right.
That it's not the Madison Avenue media culture of the late 50s, early 60s that McLuhan played off of.
No, he's sort of coming out of the Whole Earth Catalog.
Right. And the baby boomers are starting. He was born in 1938, just before baby boomers, but he's talking to the baby boomer feeling their oats. They're in their 20s and 30s by this point. And now Thompson, he did a book in 1971 called At the Edge of History, and it was nominated, made the shortlist against Stuart Brand's Whole Earth Catalog, one of those books that he put out.
Mm-hmm.
And the Whole Earth Catalog won, and Thompson knew Stuart Brand, or he eventually got to know him, so he had Thompson competing and losing to the Whole Earth Catalog, but Thompson was in that same world, so the fact both guys coming out of that Gaia world, ecology day, Earth Day kind of mentality. Both guys were nominated in 72, but at the time, Thompson got a lot of big rave reviews in New York Times, New York Review of Books, and there was a critic in Toronto who wrote a review of Thompson's book and said that Thompson was the new McLuhan. And you can read in the book, Who Was Marshall McLuhan?, which is people who knew McLuhan telling their stories about McLuhan, Frank Zangroni writes about taking Thompson, and he knew William Aaron Thompson because Thompson had met Frank Zangroni at MIT in the middle 60s, and they became friends. I'm not going to go into all details, but it's a very interesting story. And then Zangroni moves to the new university in Toronto called York University, and he brings Thompson to York University around 1968 because Thompson is frustrated with the violence in American political culture, you know, the assassinations in 68 and all that stuff. So, and he doesn't like what's happening at MIT, so he wants to retreat to Canada. And so Zangroni gives him a place at York. He becomes a star teacher there at York. And by 71, he's being reviewed in Toronto papers as the new McLuhan. So Zangroni brings Thompson to the McLuhan Seminar. And Thompson and Zangroni had seen McLuhan speak at MIT in the mid-60s, and Zangroni himself knew McLuhan since the 50s because he grew up across the street from McLuhan in Toronto, went to the same Catholic church, and was a student of McLuhan at St. Mike's eventually. So Zingroni is aware of McLuhan, but he and Thompson both experienced him at MIT, Harvard, that area in 1965 about. And so there's always this drama around McLuhan between Zingroni and Thompson, and they've remained close friends. And so Zingroni tells the story in the book, Who Was Marsh McLuhan, about what happens when Thompson is brought to the McLuhan coach house Monday night talk, and the funny vibes that between McLuhan and Thompson, because McLuhan knows that this guy is the new whippersnapper who's going to topple him. So there's that whole drama there.
And does Thompson fully embrace McLuhan at that point, or
no? He always has a problem with McLuhan because, I mean, Thompson says, he's told me this and he said it to other people. I don't know if it's in a published interview. When he was getting this high profile in Toronto in 71-72 because of his book called At the Edge of History, he was invited by the Catholic, and Thompson ostensibly is a Catholic, but he's into yoga since he grew up in L.A. and was into yoga since he was 15, so he's not your average Catholic. He was invited by the archdeacon, or whatever they call the Catholic guy in Toronto, the head guy, and he didn't like the Catholic scene, the Catholic religious hierarchy there, and he thought McLuhan was part of that, so he withdrew from that and decided to go Asian, and so he dropped out and traveled around the world, and then he hung out at Sri Aurobindo's place in India, wherever it is, and he visited physicists, and he went to Findhorn, he did all this stuff, and then he came back and dropped out of York and started Lindisfarne in on Long Island in the Hamptons in 74, about, basically started off as a commune. So he dropped out of that world and was not interested in the status that the Catholic establishment might have given him in Toronto. And so he always identified McLuhan as part of that world. He didn't understand McLuhan was less of a Catholic than Thompson was, in a sense.
But when Thompson went to hang out with Aurobindo, I would think McLuhan would see that as being kind of retro.
Oh, yeah. Remember, we're in my book, we in different contexts, just like you pointed out, Thompson had no awareness of the satellite effect, though he may not have needed it since he was responding to the post-satellite era. But to get a good handle on the post-satellite era, you got to know about the satellite environment because it's still there, just like previous environments are still there, at least as after images and as memes. So Thompson, for decades, doesn't appreciate McLuhan.
Right.
And missed a few lessons in that group, in that meme, in the McLuhan office.
So on the right side of your book, you begin with McLuhan, and then you move into Thompson. So Thompson's kind of an evolution of McLuhan on the right side of your book.
Yes. And though Croker's an evolution of McLuhan, too. Anyways, Thompson, I remember seeing a documentary on Sri Aurobindo in the early middle 70s, and the guy they quoted, he might have been a Canadian, he said, Sri Aurobindo is the closest to McLuhan we get. What was odd to me is that he brought up McLuhan. I don't know if I'm quoting him exactly, but he brought up McLuhan in that context, so I always thought that was interesting.
Who did that?
Just some guy, somebody who was interviewed in the documentary who was hanging out at Sri Aurobindo. I don't know who he was. I think he was somebody.
I don't know what way the two of them paralleled each other.
Well, wait a minute. Here's the point. The guy was probably talking to Thompson.
Oh.
Heard about McLuhan from Thompson when they were both at Sri Aurobindo's retreat.
Right.
So, or the guy just had a McLuhan sensibility. So you bring up how McLuhan would consider Sri Aurobindo obsolete, retrograde or something. It's interesting that a documentary on people associated with Sri Aurobindo talked about McLuhan.
Yeah.
Okay, so what are we saying here?
Well, the thing I wanted to do next was, since you've got Thompson sandwiched between, LaRouche and Croker in terms of, how would you contrast Thompson? We've talked about Croker, Thompson in respect to LaRouche's politics, but how would you contrast Thompson in respect to Croker's politics, who Croker, being a Marxist anarchist, is probably more radical than Thompson, I would imagine.
Well, because Thompson is sees a division between nature and technology, he doesn't see technology as nature, at least in this early phase that we're quoting from. And so he's not prepared to see technology coming alive. And he doesn't see the android meme clearly. And Croker does. So Croker has a better handle on what's coming in the 80s and 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And Thompson has to play catch-up by the late 80s.
And so Croker probably doesn't have this kind of whole earth catalog political aesthetic.
As a matter of fact, you can see quotes throughout his writings where he makes fun of the New Agers and that.
Yeah.
And he sees, if you look in the Croker, where does that start, 83, 84, the beginning of Croker, there's a section where he talks about Adorno and their book on the dialectic of enlightenment. So one of the postmodern gurus, Adorno, wrote this book after World War II in the late 40s. Thompson talks about the retrieval of the of what Adorno is critiquing, which is the Enlightenment meme from the 18th and 19th century. And Croker sees that Thompson and the New Agers retrieve the Enlightenment meme that Adorno critiques. So Croker continues the tradition of critiquing the Enlightenment myth, which becomes popularized through what we call the New Age. And I probably have that section somewhere in the Croker point. We'll see if we—if I can't find it right now, we'll see what happens when we get there. We'll probably run across it. But I thought it was in the first page, Dialectic of Enlightenment. Oh, there it is, yeah. You look on page 84 at the top. All right? See the second paragraph, first sentence.
Yeah.
It says, indeed, the text itself should be read as eminently postmodern. He's talking about his own book, The Postmodern Scene, which came out in 1986. He says, thus, for example, while Adorno and Horkheimer's Dialectic of Enlightenment, which was written in the late 40s, he says, while that book was written in response to the outbreak of the fascist mind, Croker's The Postmodern Scene, which is this quote is from, is written in response to the outbreak again of the Dialectic of Enlightenment. And that's the New Agers.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like the old battle in the 60s. The counterculture had a battle between those who wanted to be political activists out in the streets and versus those that want to retreat and drop out and go live in the country and take drugs or explore their inner space.
Mm-hmm.
You know, through yoga. So you had a division in the counterculture, which was a replay of the divisions in the 20s and 30s. So Croker is important because he sees the politicization of technology through the Android meme, which confuses Thompson from late 80s, early 90s, up till I update him when I attended his seminars. So let's... So we have this.
How long has Croker been around? When does he burst onto the scene?
Well, he starts his journal, the Canadian Journal of Political and Social Theory. Canadian Journal of Political and Social Theory starts about 1976, 1977. He's in Winnipeg, and then he moves to Montreal, becomes a teacher, professor at Concordia University in the early 80s, and then the journal is built out of there. And it's very early, head of the postmodern scene, before the postmodern people are really going to become famous. He's already writing about them and knowledgeable in their books. So he puts a little mark in the academic left world in by the early 80s. But the journal starts in 76, 77.
Mm-hmm.
And he was an editor of that with David Cook.
What distinguishes the postmodern guys?
They're an update of the political. They're like an update of the LaRouche. If you consider, in my book, I've got LaRouche and Croker on one side. They're political in conventional terms. On the right side, McLuhan and Thompson are not political in the conventional terms. Croker continues the political in the street world, encountering the Android meme, which has disappeared public space for politics to operate in.
Mm-hmm.
That's what LaRouche doesn't realize. McLuhan realizes that and takes on the politicization of the coming Android meme. He anticipates what Croker is dealing with, and Croker learns a lot from McLuhan. And Thompson believes that politics is through enlightenment, getting over your fear of death and going into meditative states of enhanced transcendent awareness. He thinks that's political.
Uh-huh.
Though Thompson would not limit himself to that, he knows that you've got to still be political, and that's why he would write tracts against LaRouche and try to get something going in the Democratic Party that led to the Green Party.
Right.
So all of these people in my book are uncategorizable. They're in the worlds of
right.
politics, sex, God, and consciousness, and the Baroque spirals of the Android meme. They're in the middle of all of them. But in general, their media image puts them on one place as opposed to another.
Right.
And people's surface reading of them will put them in one place or another. You got to read a lot of Thompson to realize the sophistication and subtlety of what he's dealing with. He's not just a New Ager.
Yeah. Well, it occurs to me one of the things that distinguishes Croker from Thompson is that Croker goes multimedia when he publishes, when he collaborates with that guy on that musical album, conceptual album called Spasm.
Yeah, well, he did it in the late 80s with the Panic Encyclopedia, the book that came out in the late 80s, they put out a record. So he was doing it before Spasm, which came out in 93.
Yeah.
He was always doing multimedia if he could.
Yeah.
Yeah, he did multimedia. The best that Thompson did was a performance with a computer scene in the Cathedral St. John the Divine in the early 90s. He always hoped that David Byrne of Talking Heads would do something with him and make a video of his charts. But he never hooked up with the guy.
Yeah.
So in this quote I'm just going to read it again. In light of thinking of big is bad and small is beautiful, and that the digitalization of our technology makes the small more practical, with that in mind, here's what he's saying. In a planetary, now he calls them contemplatives, all right? But it's a comprehensive meaning of contemplatives. It's just not dropouts, though it sounds like a dropout, but it's someone active in making holistic technological environments that his friend the Todds invented. The Todds discovered a way to process, I think it's garbage, that China is now buying. Better way of recycling garbage and pollution, a holistic way. So technology like that, Thompson is for. So it's not just sitting around doing nothing. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
He's definitely not into building more dams and more nuclear plants like LaRouche is
mm-hmm.
advocating, right? You got that?
Yeah.
Thompson would say, let's go to the moon through our astrobodies. And Thompson and LaRouche says, did I say Croker back there? I meant LaRouche advocates nuclear plants.
Right. Yeah, I think you said that right.
Okay. So Thompson says, go to the moon through the astrobody, whereas LaRouche says, let's pour billions into a crash program to put a woman on Mars through satellites and rockets and
yeah.
spaceships.
And, you know, best of both worlds, do both.
Yeah. Now Thompson is aware of that, too. Okay. But he's being, this is an early book, early and mid-70s. So he's saying, in a planetary village of contemplatives, nature could be great, the machines tiny, and man in just proportion between the two. There's the gap. He's got the interval there. He knows that man is neither machine nor nature. No longer need there be economies of scale in which massive amounts of fossil fuel are used to grow wheat in vast acreages so that huge trucks can burn gasoline to take flour into the enormous cities where great factories can make Ritz crackers that then can then be trucked again to the airports so that jumbo jets can fly them down to Venezuela, where multinational forms of advertising can convince the peasants to abandon their locally made tortillas in favor of the creations of Nabisco. Now, here is Thompson, building on McLuhan, critiquing the massive hot culture of industry.
Yeah.
And saying we can move to a cool culture with the increasing miniaturization of technology.
Yeah.
So he's building on McLuhan's critique of the hot industrial center margin structures. Whereas with the cool digital world, There are no centers, no margins. Centers everywhere. So he says, no longer would Madison Avenue heat up the economy so that shoddily built goods with built-in obsolescence could destroy non-renewable resources and produce disastrous pollution. In industrial society, you are what you own. In contemplative cultures, your being is the source of your identity. Contemplatives need less, consume less, and therefore can produce less. And he's taking that as a positive. Produce less, less pollution, less extra redundant consumable products. But remember, reading LaRouche, the society has to produce more on basic infrastructure to survive. So Thompson is the exact opposite of LaRouche in terms of political economy. Thompson, LaRouche would say that Thompson's deluded to think that a society could evolve and maintain a stable form of wealth and security by just maintaining holistic environments. LaRouche says, no, you got to keep plunging ahead and even getting better technology. But Thompson would agree with LaRouche on a certain level and say that LaRouche doesn't understand the effects of the newer, better technologies that are coming in and still is projecting a hot image on a new kind of effect from the better technology.
Sure.
In contemplative cultures, your being is the source of your identity. Contemplatives need less, consume less, and therefore can produce less. I would say as long as you got the digital technology to do that. No man need labor, Thompson continues, no man need labor 8 hours a day at the same dreary task of putting a door on a Cadillac. In industrial culture, poverty is a disgrace. In contemplative culture, poverty is the elegance of simplicity. Say a person like Thomas Merton or Gary Snyder is someone Thompson would recommend, someone who live in the elegance of simplicity. It's kind of, the hip beat idea, the beatnik idea of the 50s.
You know, the thing actually where I see he may be missing LaRouche's point is the fact that LaRouche is recognizing the fact that the population of this planet is continuing to double every so many years.
Yeah.
And so technology has to keep pace in order to be able to accommodate all these more and more people. Whereas these sort of whole earth technologies are great with a population that's moderated.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure that they can actually tolerate a population that keeps doubling every so many years.
Right, and it's that's LaRouche would say that Thompson's working within the Malthusian paradigm and those that want to reduce population growth. And LaRouche said, no, we need more people to man the new technologies that we need to survive. And so because we were really failing in those agendas, we were heading into a real plagues and wars everywhere and the whole dark scene that LaRouche says is the end of civilization. But the LaRouche is saying we still need the mass or hot culture form of industrial organization to deal with the huge population coming.
I mean, yeah, the fact is there's no governing body that can modulate the population on this planet, and the population is continuing to grow. So there's no point in being philosophical about what sort of technology we could have if we could modulate population. It ain't happening. We have to figure out how are we going to accommodate the coming boom in population, which is coming, continuing to come.
Yeah, and you have to develop what you have, and that's nuclear energy. It's the only thing on the table right now, even though LaRouche sees the advantage of coal fusion, if someone could get that off the ground. But at this point, we got to deal with the big energy needs. He's still operating from the industrial model, right? The center margin structure, which
right.
is true because industrialization is just new for a large part of the third world.
Right.
And they're and McLuhan would predict that they would move into those Western modes.
So this is interesting. McLuhan's vision of the fact that population is continuing to become denser as time goes on is that
that's LaRouche's vision.
LaRouche is saying we can handle this if we get on the right technological bandwagon, and from what I've read of Thompson thinks, yeah, it's inevitable that the population is going to continue to double, but also what's inevitable is that some cataclysm is going to come and kill us all off once it gets past a critical threshold.
That's
so
right.
He can't vision the population going beyond a certain point, whereas LaRouche says, yeah, well, we can handle it.
Yes, and so Gnosticism, the New Age, is a lot of a retrieval of Gnosticism, is in the Thompson zone of my book, and it's in the Thompson quadrant of my chart. is that there's a Gnostic level of all this is going to blow up, and they call it a singularity or some kind of transcendence, and so therefore you don't deal with the practical, which we've read for many hours, LaRouche is advocating and doesn't like the Gnostic vision. So you have on the surface here a Gnostic division, a Gnostic vision coming out of Thompson here, right?
Yeah.
And LaRouche is saying, well, that's it's not going to happen in some weird metaphysical 2012 singularity. It's just going to be massive plagues and wars and drug dealing and dumbed down population and collapsed civilization. That'll be the singularity.
Mm-hmm.
He puts it in hardware terms, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the problem is, as McLuhan points out, is that you're inside a weird singularity, which is the global theater effect, the merger of radio, TV, satellite, and computer in the 60s creates a technological singularity already. And that confuses anybody's agenda. LaRouche can't get his agenda off the ground confronting that early part of the Android meme. Thompson can't really drop out of into any place because it's inside the coming Android meme. And McLuhan is the one who points out that part of the question.
Yeah. The fact is, no political agenda. You know, there's all these rumors of the secret government, the Illuminati behind the scenes, which is, you know, actually the whatever the Council of Ten or whoever's really controlling everything from behind the scenes. But the fact is, there's no agenda which is going to dictate universal politics for this planet.
No conceptual agenda.
Yeah.
But McLuhan would say the agenda that does dictate is the effect of the communication environment we're living in.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're in a TV culture, that's what dictates all the people trying to put messages out, regardless of what institution or meme they represent.
Right. But the fact is, we can't modulate TV culture or technological cultures any better than we can modulate population explosion.
Yeah, and McLuhan has a solution, use the computer. But nobody understood him, and that didn't happen. So what you're saying is that no verbal agenda, no written agenda, which we'll call conceptual, either way, verbal or written.
No political manifesto.
Yeah, no logocentric, the postmodernists would call it logocentric, mouth-oriented, somebody saying something, everybody gathers around that mouth and that oratory and that idea or those written pamphlets, which LaRouche puts out, you know, 10 times a day. That's a puny medium inside the global theater, and then it's even more absurd when you get into this miniaturized global theater that Thompson is talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So Thompson is trying to deal with the new media communication matrix effect, but he is hoiking up the idea there is a nature
mm-hmm.
that is not as worth preserving in relation to the machines. So he hopes the machines get tiny, so nature can be great again, as he says in the first line.
Well, machines are going in that direction. I mean, nanotechnology is all the rage.
Right, so then Thompson's on the right track here.
Mm-hmm.
No longer do we have to modulate the global environments like McLuhan advocates, like an air traffic controller. We're moving into miniaturization, which McLuhan, he understood the miniaturization. He knew Bucky Fuller and mentions it here and there. He made a joke on that. He said, we are doing more and more with less and less. And he said that led to the situation where we know more and more about less and less.
Yeah.
And that is the bugaboo of specialization, knowing more and more about less and less. So the miniaturization is, so Thompson, him emphasizing nature being retrieved, that would be, you could say, the chemical body confronting the miniaturization of media may make one think you're going back to nature.
Mm-hmm.
So it's definitely an effect in the 70s, and you could say, as technology wasn't shrinking as much as it became today, but it was beginning to, and people were starting to get autonomy with cable TV and audio cassettes, tape cassettes, the 8-track, all those things allowed people to disconnect from the one-way media tyranny. That's the beginning of the Small's Beautiful concept.
Yeah, with respect to the chemical body miniaturization that's going on, because in the old days, when they would take in cadavers and studying anatomy, they'd be looking at the mapping the organs and how they all fit together like a bunch of plumbing or whatever. Now these guys are looking at you know, the organic biologists are looking at the gene structure. Talk about the miniaturization. I mean, the chemical body looks like a machine on that level, and they're looking down at the nano level at how this machine works.
Yeah. And so your point is?
Well, that miniaturization doesn't just have to do with nanotechnology and making little industrial machines. It has to do with actually examining that the chemical body is a kind of a nano. You know, you can look at it down at the nano level and see what's going on there at the miniature level.
Well, that's McLuhan's point, that the tools you use to investigate the chemical body create the images of the chemical body.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The tools
right.
evoke the images you're going to use. So that's the medium is the message. So how does that relate to Thompson?
I don't know. It's just a thought that occurred to me that, you know, if he's talking, you're talking about the miniaturization of almost like industrial technology or electronic circuitry, but I'm just noticing that there's an analogy to that between also the miniaturization of the exploration of the miniature of within the chemical body, that you're looking at the miniature on two scales, one which is first nature, which is what the, you know, down at the gene level, which is what first nature gave us. The other one is on the technological level that we created, you know, going down to shrinking machines down to nanotechnology or computer circuits or whatever. There's a parallel there.
The second nature technologies of the nanotechnology going into the body are still maybe exploring second nature, because the images evoked by the miniaturized technologies are the images you project on the body.
Right.
So I always
there's a place where we may begin to